I call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order at 1:30 p.m. on Tuesday, February 2nd. Happy Marmot Day for those folks in Alaska. Happy Groundhog's Day for you lower 48ers. We do have a quorum to do business. We're meeting today in room 205 of the Capitol Building. Please remember to silence your cell phones as a courteous. Committee members in present today is Senator Hughes, Senator Costello, Senator Reinbolt, Senator Begich, and myself, Senator Wilson. Welcome back to folks. This is our first meeting of the year. I'd like to introduce our returning committee aide, Chief of Staff, Jody Simpson. Our Senate Records Recorder, Ms. Jeannie Froy, is also returning this year. And we have Carlson, our teleconference moderator. This is our first order of business this afternoon is to elect a vice chair, Senator Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move and ask unanimous consent that Senator Hughes be elected as vice chair.
Is there any objection? Without objection, so ordered. Senator Hughes will serve as vice chair. Welcome aboard, Senator Hughes. Vice Chair Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Before we begin, just also want to remind folks just about some committee decorum throughout this session. Remember, please don't try to take phone calls or actively continue to text folks while in committee. If you need to leave, by all means, just step aside outside, take care of your business, or ask for an at ease so we can have a smooth operation of business. Committee folks can feel free. We'll try to get the presentation out to committee members as soon as possible so that questions can be asked the presenters. If you need to get a question on the record, by all means, ask those questions, but we try to make sure that we can get as much information as possible, and feel free to direct those questions directly to the presenters ahead of time so that information can be, we can have our committee meetings a little bit more efficient. And if you ask for presenters to request information, that information is going to be distributed throughout the entire committee. At this time, we're going to take up Senate Bill 56, the COVID Disaster Extension, sponsored by Senate Rules on behalf of the governor. Please note there is new materials on your desk. This includes a new indeterminate physical note from the Department of Revenue. Today to address the committee is Commissioner Adam Crum from the Department of Health and Social Services. We have Director Heidi Hedberg from the Division of Public Health, Department of Health and Social Services. And I thought we have one. Nope, just those two. So this time, if Commissioner would like to come up and get ready, and then for questions, we will pause throughout the slides and allow members to ask questions. We are going to pause at different points in the slides. Feel free after each sectional in there, we'll pause to take questions. Otherwise, we're going to try to get through the presentation and allow time to allow for public testimony, as that is more important now since we are don't have an open building for the public, and this is, we want to make sure we have an opportunity for the public to take process within this committee. It's all yours, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Adam Crum, and I serve as the Commissioner for the Department of Health and Social Services, and thank you also to the other members of the Health and Social Services Committee. Mr. Chair, I'd also like to point out, along with Public Health Director Heidi Hedberg, we do have, who also helped present, is Brian Fisher, Incident Commander for the State, employee of DMVA, as well as Dr. Zink will be online available for questions. So throughout this, Mr. Chairman, we'd appreciate just the committee and their consideration of Senate Bill 56, extending the COVID emergency declaration. Today, I'd like to walk through a sectional analysis of SB 56. Incident Commander Brian Fisher will provide an overview of Alaska Statute 2623, the Alaska Disaster Act. Then I'd like to move to a high-level walkthrough of the public health emergency, the disaster declaration timeline, and major components of the Alaska response. Then Heidi Hedberg, Director of the Division of Public Health, will discuss the authority under AS 2623020 and how the authorities were used in the state response and why these authorities are needed for an extended disaster declaration as proposed by Senate Bill 56. For the sectional analysis, Mr. Chairman, before I begin walking the committee through SB 56, I'd like to inform the committee that there are representatives online from the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, the Office of Management and Budget, Department of Public Safety, the Department of Revenue, and the Department of Law to answer questions about particular sections of the bill that impact their respective departments and programs. First off, through section one is the findings section. This just establishes the chronology of SARS-CoV-2, the virus which leads to COVID-19, and the state of Alaska response to the imminent threat and the outbreak of COVID-19 in Alaska. It includes a description of federal agency actions in approving of emergency use authorizations, or EUA, for the immediate nationwide distribution of a COVID-19 vaccination, which occurred on December 11th, 2020, and the need for statewide response under Alaska Statute 1815.390 to address the public health disaster emergency and aid in vaccine distribution across the state. Section 2 talks about the extension of the disaster emergency, and it extends it from January 15, 2021 to September 30, 2021. This provides that the Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services may certify to the governor that there is no longer a present outbreak of COVID-19 or a credible threat, and I shall submit a proclamation to the legislature that indicates that the public health disaster emergency no longer exists.
Any questions here for Senator Baggage? And then we'll go to Senator Reinbold. And
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I want to put on the record, I objected to the governor's claimed extension of these orders as unconstitutional, and I want to be clear about that. I speak for my caucus when I say that it's none of us objects to the idea of their public safety being paramount. We do object to the governor asserting his authority in an inappropriate manner in this regard. And I want you to know that I'm going to question this legislation on two counts. One is the whereas clauses that specifically speak to the extension of those orders, which I believe are unconstitutional, but secondarily to the extension all the way to September 30th in what I think, at least in my opinion, is going to be a relatively illegal extension of this order. So with that in mind, I want you also to know that I support the efforts of the department in public health, and I back the medical decisions that have been made by the department, because I think that they have ensured that we are in the position we are in today, which is to be the state with the highest level of vaccinations. You've indicated there are others on the way as well, and that we are with the lowest mortality rate, one of the lowest mortality rates per capita. And so I want to commend you for that, but let you know that there are constitutional issues at bear here, and that they're going to make your job a little more difficult, but we want to work with you to ensure that we can do this in the smoothest possible way, but we must also address these constitutional issues. Mr. Chairman, thank you for that.
And I'm just going to address here quickly for committee members that we're not going to spend time on the constitutionality of the past in this committee. That's not the purview of this. We're hearing the extension that's before us, not addressing the ones in October or November or December. I mean, like November or December's order. We're only addressing the one that's before us. So we're not going to continue on because...
But, Mr. Chairman, just as a point of record, they're referred to in the legislation.
I understand that. I'm just stating that that's not the purpose of this committee. That's not the purview of this hearing today. Is we're going to address the extension as is going forth, not the ones in the past. Senator Reinbold.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I definitely appreciate the comments of the colleague across the way. I would like to have the opportunity to discuss the constitutionality of this and the past. This is the very first hearing we've had, the very first time the legislature has had the opportunity to weigh on one of the biggest events in the history of Alaska, and the Health and Social Services has been at the helm. So I'm going to try to stick with the question right before us. You said a credible threat. Can you define credible threat, disaster, and what data you're using? I believe you said in my committee that you were using the UAA data. So if you could address those three things, because I think the premise of what you're declaring the disaster on is very, very important. And I've actually found four very powerful research documents that show the data that you used is significantly flawed, the Imperial College data. So first we have to... we have to get that on the record. And so, and then if you could go ahead and answer those three questions, that would be great.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold. So as we look at this, when we talk about what is a credible threat, has to do with the mission of what Health and Social Services, and that is to protect and promote the health and well-being of all Alaskans. And so we have federal agencies that we work with and partner with, this being CDC, FDA, and we look at ASPR, these agencies that do disaster response preparedness. And as we look at these, we follow their lead. We see what they have to say. And if there's any specific Alaska tweaks to our policy or how we administer items, then we would do such. So those are items that we look at to see what is happening in other states across the country. Can we use the position of Alaska geographically to our advantage and also work on some items like that? But when it comes to, items and data that you had mentioned before, there was initial modeling that came out that had just out outrageous numbers about where we were going and the deaths. And this came from, different COVID Act now, the University of Washington's IHME, the University of King's College in London, all across the board. And they were all in the similar vein. We looked at, it's not just one single study at a time. You look at across the board what is happening, as well as the context of the situation that is occurring, both around the world and in the United States as well. And so when we looked at those, and admittedly, those projections ended up being fatally flawed. But we did still see quite a few states actually reach their breaking point to where hospitals did have situations of capacity. And knowing that in Alaska, having less than 2% of acute care beds for our population, we want to make sure we were taking care of that, because as we've seen even throughout this response, it being a very long year, we've had hurricanes across southwest Alaska and western Alaska that have delayed people getting care, people being transported out, and even us delivering goods for the response. And so those are some of the data points that we use when making our decisions for Alaska.
Senator Reinbold?
So you said that the data you used was fatally flawed. I think that's very, very important, because that pretty much agrees with this tremendous research that I'd like, Mr. Chairman. I emailed this to you, and I would like this to become part of the official committee hearing, because as Senator Begich said, it is part of the bill. So it's very, very important. And also I'd like part of the hearing to be for UAA, the model that they were used. I think it's really important, because the first thing you have to do is talk about why the disaster was declared in the first place and what information, and then there was a bunch of mandates, as you know, 18 of them, that were pursued based on the declaration. But if it's based on a faulty model, it kind of throws everything else out the window. So I think it's really important to get the basis, the premise on record. So, Mr. Chairman, I would ask, with your privilege of being the chair, that you would include this, and I did, out of courtesy, send this to you.
Thank you.
So, and then can I finish asking him?
Yeah, just a quick moment here. I just want to recognize that we were joined by the Senate President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So you didn't define what credible threat means, and I think that's really important. And you said that you were to promote the health of all Alaskans. Lots and lots of Alaskans are suffering an unprecedented number because of the mandates and this ongoing disaster declaration. So, you know, that causes me tremendous pause as I've talked with you. Roughly about 1 in 4 children are suffering because of the lockdowns and the mandates and school being shut like that. And to me, my heart goes out to them and the parents that are suffering. So, you know, if you're looking out for the health of all Alaskans, this is certainly not the way to do it. So, you know, and that's what I'm glad to hear you say that, because holistically, we have to look out for the health and well-being economically of our students, you know, of our constitutional rights. You said you took an oath to the Constitution on that is the supreme law of life. So I think that's really important. So, one, I still need credible threat, because the numbers, I mean, you know what the numbers are looking like right now. So that's one thing I need. The geographic, you just talked about, the geographic. London is a very high dense place. Alaska is very widespread. So that's another reason why I think the models were very flawed for Alaska. We're very spacious, but yet those models were, you know, a lot of the things that they recommended in there, you applied to the mandates. And the third point, you said that 2% of acute care hospital beds, the whole disaster got extended, and I'd like to see that data. So through the chair, Mr. Chairman, if we could see the data that they based the disaster declaration extensions on, I would greatly appreciate that, because I have been requesting that information for quite some time, and it's really, really important. If an extension was based on information, we have the right to have the information that it was extended on. And with that, Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you. And I think some of that will be gone over through in the presentation a little bit later on. And if it's not, then we can definitely get back to that. All right, Senator Costello.
Thank you, and thank you, Commissioner, for being here before the committee. I do want to say that I can't support an extension of a disaster declaration into the end of September of this year. I think it sends the wrong message to suffering Alaskans that things will not change and we'll be in a situation of a lockdown. I think it sends the wrong message. I do want to know why the administration did not consider just extending every 30 days, and I'm anticipating that your answer is going to be what I read in the material, which is you want to align this disaster declaration to align with the federal budget cycle. Our budget cycle has never been aligned with the federal budget cycle. It has never prevented Alaska from receiving federal funds. And certainly, I mean, I cannot speak for the members of this committee, but we are definitely interested in receiving funds from the federal government to help suffering Alaska families. However, I think that that is something that that we should seriously consider, and I can't support an extension well into September of this year. So could you tell us why the administration did not just consider extending for 30 days?
Through the chair, Senator Costello. So extend for 30 days via legislative extension, or are you talking about a governor declaration?
Oh, you can answer both, actually.
So this is legislature in session in a meeting. I apologize, through the chair. It is up to the legislature to extend that, so that was where that came from. When the date of September 30th came forward, the federal public health emergency actually comes through the Department of Health and Human Services. And so they do it in 90-day sections at a time. And so each time they do an extension, if it enters into a quarter or of the year, then the benefits of that public health emergency go through the end of that quarter. For an example being the enhanced FMAP of 6.2% to the Medicaid program, if that touches the prior one was supposed to end January 20th, but because it went into January, meaning we would receive the benefits as a state until the end of this quarter. And so that is one reason why, as we anticipate, Secretary Azar actually put forward an extension on January 21st for 90 days, in that we look at with President Biden that his administration wouldn't allow the public health emergencies to expire in his first 100 days, knowing that there would be at least one more extension from his appointed Health and Human Services Secretary. That was where the anticipation of going to September 30th to a lineup, because some of the flexibilities that are afforded under Health and Human Services have a lot to do with the delivery of healthcare systems, and those flexibilities are tied to the federal public health emergency. And that was one of the time frames. It wasn't necessarily the funding perspective, it was the flexibilities that were allowed in order to respond to this, and then how we as a state can respond to those flexibilities by waiver, suspension of regulation, and statute.
Follow up, Senator?
Thank you. I mean, I understand the desire to be flexible and malleable. However, I think to take an entire legislative branch, which is the people's branch, and to essentially take us out of the equation is problematic for me. The legislature is planning on being very responsive to the needs of Alaskans and to the federal funding, and I don't see that there would be any problem with getting the legislature to extend if that were needed. And so, again, the date of September 30th, 2021 is highly problematic for me and my constituents, and I'd like to work with members of the committee and with your department on finding something that is much more palatable. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Yes.
I apologize, Mr. Chair. One more item is, after we had submitted the bill, we actually did receive a letter from the acting Health and Human Services Secretary, who actually said that it is the intention of the Biden administration to continue the public health emergency through at least the end of calendar year 21. But I just want to make sure the committee is aware of that as well.
Thank you. Senator Hughes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll start off by saying that I appreciate the concerns expressed thus far by the committee, and I share those and look forward to addressing them. I am going to be interested in hearing the case that the administration presents, and I appreciate your being willing sometimes to be what would be considered quite the hot seat, Commissioner Crum. One of the things I'm concerned about is the legislative branch having the ability to end a disaster declaration, and I don't believe that's currently in the bill. Correct me if I'm wrong. But that would be one thing. If it is the will of this committee to move this bill out, if it's the will of the Senate to pass this on the floor, is that we consider adding the ability for the legislature to determine at any point to end the emergency declaration. My question, all I've said really doesn't have anything to do with my question, but I want to get that on the record. The FMAP, 6.2%, that is related to the pandemic. Is it necessary? So if President Biden continues to extend the public emergency and make that 6.2 FMAP enhancement available to the states. Is it required that a state have an existing emergency declaration in place in order to receive that 6.2% enhancement?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, no.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Imbol.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I didn't hear what a credible threat was. I need that defined. I also need disaster defined. And then I also want to get into some of the things that Senator Hughes was talking about. That's the money. The legislature has the power of the purse, and I want to ask a question about how much you guys have been redistributing, but I think it's really important first to get the credible threat defined disaster, because a lot of people think the disaster was declared based on faulty information. However, some of the mandates that you have your name stamped all over in the governor, and Dr. Zink is actually creating a catastrophe economically, constitutionally, you know, in the, and I personally can tell you that I feel completely sidelined by you guys, because I want to know how much money has extra. Your budget, definitely, your budget is huge, and then I want to know how much additional funding you got. But let's start with the credible threat, defining disaster. We'll start with those two.
To the chair, Senator Reinbold, Incident Commander Brian Fisher will actually go over the entire Alaska Disaster Act and what that means in Alaska.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
That's not my question. I've read it over and over again. My question is, what is a credible threat? Define the disaster that you're declaring in the bill and what you've done. And also, I need a yes or a no. Can I get the information, complete information, that the disaster was declared on based on hospital capacity? I just need a yes or no, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. We understand. I think that what Commissioner Crum is saying, that the incident commander can give us that information and define that to us. And he's online now. Brian, I'm sorry. Fisher, yes, Mr. Fisher. And if the Mr. Fisher can give that to the committee, that would be a wonderful. And then I'll let the commissioner answer. And then we got to continue to move on, because we got a lot of – we're only on session two of this bill, and we need to finish and let the opportunity to allow them to finish presenting, and then we can go through questions continue. But please answer that, and then please continue on with section three.
Madam Chair, the next section will actually have the entire overview of the Alaska Disaster Act, which gives the definition of the word disaster in Alaska. So that is what Incident Commander Fisher will address. As far as the credible threat side goes, this has to go with the information and context available at the time that we use, and each time we look at this is moving forward. And so I'd be happy to sit down and put in writing a response to the committee for an item and what that would be.
Thank you.
So section three, the financing plan. So this just establishes the finance plan for the disaster declaration. Components of this the finance plan are the same appropriations that were made in 2020. That supported the March 11th disaster declaration that was extended to November 15th. The expenditure of CARES Act receipts ratified by the legislature and any future appropriations that may be made for FY21 or FY22. In addition, the governor may not expend more than $10 million from the disaster relief fund for the emergency declared on January 15th and extended to September 30th, 2021. As far as the next section, section four, is the report to the legislature. This does require OMB to submit a monthly report to the Legislative Finance Division that lists the total expenditures incurred by the state in its response to the public health emergency disaster, including expenditures aimed at mitigating, preventing, and controlling COVID-19. The report will include cumulative expenses incurred since March 11th, 2020, the date the governor issued an initial declaration of a public health disaster. This section further provides for a final report due to the Legislative Finance Division no later than November 30th, 2021, or 60 days after the governor determines the public health disaster emergency no longer exists, whichever is earlier.
Questions on those two? Senator Reinbold.
First of all, it sounds like, you know, any of us can read the Disaster Act. I mean, we understand that. But it sounds like a lot of people do not believe there's an emergency right now. And it sounds like, one, you cannot define the emergency. It sounds like you cannot define the disaster. So I'm going to have to fill in the blanks here. And you cannot define imminent threat. So what my question to you is, in regards to the disaster, it's going on, it's coming up on a year, one full year, when the statutes say 30 days. How can you justify extending this? If you're to look out for the health and well-being of all Alaskans, and this is causing tremendous harm, as you know, I just want straight up. How can you justify extending this, knowing how many people, how many businesses are suffering, how many children are suffering, how many rights are being violated? How can you justify this?
So let me, there's going to be a section later on in the presentation to explain to the general public some of the differences in Title 21 versus the Alaska this gubernatorial mandate through the administration versus local mandates. And I think that there's a huge bit of confusion that one does not need to happen without the other. And so, and that's coming up later throughout this presentation, I believe.
Yes, sir.
But please, if you want to answer.
So I apologize. What was?
First of all, are you able to clearly define what a credible threat is, clearly define the disaster, clearly justify the extension of the disaster, and four, as I asked earlier, can I, yes or no, get all the data that the disaster based on hospital beds was?
And that is a broad term, so I think we should narrow that down a little bit more. Maybe that can be given to the department in writing of what you're seeking for.
It's been given multiple times.
Okay. So if you're looking for, yeah, hospital capacity, that's something that I believe that's on the data dashboard that they can compile for us. But, you know, like I said, I believe the commissioner already answered the other two questions already, the other three questions on the data. I'm sorry, on the disaster, the credible, and that they're going to provide that later to us.
Through the chair, Mr. Chairman. So the answer is no. I cannot get the hospital. I've been asking. I've been emailing. I've been FOIAing.
We did not say no. We said that that's something that for the hospital capacity, that is something that's on the dashboard that the department is going to nod yes that they can provide that information to us.
Through the chair, one more final.
Yes.
They changed some of the parameters, and I've been trying to drill down and get the information. I've been sending FOIAing information for months, and I have not been given the information, and that's why this may be my only opportunity. The people deserve to know why this disaster was declared in December based on hospital beds, and their whole lives are being transformed, a lot of people. I can tell you what's happening on the slope. I can go on and on and on. But we need to know the basis, the premise of why the disaster was declared.
And so we're not going to go into the premise of the disaster declaration. We're going to address the bill that's in front of us right now, and that's the focus of what we're here today. As we said earlier, we're not going to go into the past. We're here today to address the bill in front of us, and this is what we have in front of us today to address. And so basically, you know, my goal and the intent is that it was stated earlier upon, you know, the legislature had the ability to meet, and the legislature did not. We failed to act positively. We failed to act negatively to vote this up or down. My intent is to get this in front of the legislative body so they can make a decision to vote affirmative or to vote in the negative of this bill. And so that is the intent that the chair has, and that's what my intent is, trying to get this through so we can make a decision one way or the other as a legislative body. Please continue to Section 4.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm on Section 5 now, which is the professional.
Yes, Senator Hughes.
Yeah, I'd just like to tie in Senator Reinbold's question with your remarks, because I know we're not going back to revisit the past. We're looking at this point forward as far as what SB 56 would mean for Alaska in the here and now and in the coming year. And so part of it related to the data from the past, what I would like, and I did speak to Commissioner ahead of time, I would like to know the data upon that would be the basis for ending disaster declaration, because it shouldn't just be like, well, we feel like things are settled down, we think it's okay to repeal or stop the declaration, but I'd like to know the data. So right, if they're going to have a point at which they will decide that we don't need it anymore, I think that we as legislators need to know what that is. And in reference to that, we need to know where we are now. So if it's based on hospital capacity, what are our targets? I think that is data that we're going to need, and perhaps the administration is going to present that to us. But I just want to get that on record, because although we're not revisiting the past, we need that in our decision-making as we go forward.
No, and that is germane, as it's in Section 4 of the end date of this disaster. And so that's fine.
In regards to her question.
We're going to continue on to Senator Reinbold.
Okay. Well, this is just to echo on what Senator Begich, which I thought were good questions, as well as Senator Hughes. If we're not looking back, then we can't look at this bill, because this talks about December 16th. That talks about January 12th. It talks about March 12th, 2020. It talks about April 9th, 2020, November 16th, 2020. The whole bill, I mean, it's like five pages, and like two pages is past dates. So we are looking at the past.
In terms of the bill, in terms of the finance plan, yes, that's referenced there, as it would be simpler and saves on so numerous number of trees to do that. If we would like, we can print out the entire those items and pass that out to committee members for their reference of how that financial plan would be dispersed. And I just thought that was a simpler way of documenting those than passing out the entire making this bill a 5780 page bill.
Mr. Chairman, just point of order in here.
Yes. Senator Reinbold.
This talks about the diagnoses on March 12th. It has nothing to do with the financial plan. On line 23, page 2, it talks about the number of cases. So yeah. All of this is incredibly germane.
Right.
And we are talking about the past. This has nothing to do with the fiscal notes of the financial plan. This is in the bill itself.
Yes. And there's a lot of information to answer a lot of these questions. But we must allow the commissioner and his presenters the opportunity, and we also have folks on for testimony as well that can add to these to the conversation. Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So for the record, this is Commissioner Crum. So Section 5, Professional Occupational Licensing, this is administered by the Director of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. States items about may not increase licensing fees during the public health disaster emergency declaration, that you can grant licenses or permit or certificates on an expedited basis if an individual holds a corresponding license permit in good standing in another jurisdiction. This really is our expedited means of getting healthcare workers to the state in the event of a surge. May temporarily waive or modify continuing education requirements for licensees who need to renew. Can require an individual who receives a license, permit, or certificate to arrange and agree to supervision by an individual who holds one. This actually was an act that the legislature put, or an item the legislature put forward to allow student attendees, as in nursing students, actually start providing health care. So this section also provides that a licensed professional seeking or holding an expedited license, permit, or certificate under this section who travels to Alaska from outside of Alaska must comply with the travel restriction orders or guidelines recommended by the CDC.
Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just in terms of this, I know some of this is part of the report process, and I just want to clarify that when we're dealing with the numbers here, the numbers of people that are receiving these temporary licenses, those are part of the report generally, right? That you provide, you provide fairly regular updates.
Through the chair to Senator Begich, I believe so, sir.
And here's my only question here is, have you guys has the department examined the implications toward requirements for professional certification that this temporary professional certification leads to? So, for example, if a position A, maybe it's a nurse practitioner, requires a certain level of nurse practitioner level that we've granted in an emergency on an emergency basis, but that isn't part of the normal training of a nurse practitioner, post this disaster declaration, will they then be qualified as a result of the emergency qualification? In other words, are they getting a leap over those who are actually taking coursework in this? And I just want to know what the unintended consequences of this are. And then secondarily, Mr. Chairman, if I may, secondarily, it's how has this impacted the workforce of our nurses, our other paraprofessionals and professionals who may have been perhaps as a result of certifications of out-of-state folks been knocked out of work, that kind of thing. Have we analyzed that, or are we planning to analyze that?
So through the chair, Senator Begich, the second half of that question doesn't need to be. It's been a supplement. We haven't seen any bumping. That those individuals still have to work and operate under their professional boards and licenses. The first part of your question, actually, I'm going to throw to, if it's through the chair, if it permits it, to Sarah Chambers, Director of Corporations Business Professional Licensing, is online, and she may be able to answer that question about the experience component.
Yes. Director Chambers?
Oh. And so to clarify for Director Chambers, if I may, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
What I'm getting at here is I don't want us to inadvertently miss some of our professional qualification that is necessary for certification in a field as a result of this very extended disaster declaration that can create a false sense of experience that may not be relevant to the educational experience a person normally would have to go through to certify in one of these professional positions.
Yes. Director Chambers, are you online and able to answer Senator Begich's question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Sarah Chambers. I'm the director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. Through the chair, Senator Begich, those are excellent questions. And we have seen that the greatest need for these emergency courtesy licenses are for the unusual circumstances that have arisen due to COVID. For example, when areas in rural Alaska have been hit hard, particularly some of the areas where there might be, economic activity such as mining or commercial fishing happening, and there isn't a strong workforce that can meet the needs of all of the COVID patients and mitigations that need to happen, we have been able to use the courtesy licenses to be able to bring people up who would otherwise not be going to work, say, in an Anchorage hospital or, a Mat-Su clinic, which is an unusual circumstance that the Alaska workforce couldn't meet. We've seen a few different circumstances like that. We've also made sure when we've worked with our various boards, because these are board decisions, when we've worked with the various boards, that they are setting side rails up that will say that these courtesy licenses do not supplant a regular license. If you need to work in a hospital for performing regular duties, then you need a regular license, and there is an end date to these licenses. It's all dependent on the particular board. But the boards were very conscientious about putting up side rails to make sure that this did not create a property right for someone to then leap, I think, to use your word, over someone else who might be needing to meet higher standards in order to permanently practice under a full license.
Senator Begich?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That does answer my question. I'm satisfied with the answer. I just, on another point that you brought up earlier, detailing our coming together as a body and bringing us together, it's also not just the legislature's responsibility. The governor also has the power to bring us back together, should he desire to. I just wanted to put that on the record since you mentioned the other. Thank you very much, Sarah. That got to my question.
Yes, Senator Rambold.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hey, this is for Sarah.
Yes, Director Chambers, please don't leave the line yet. Senator Rambold.
So, Sarah, thank you for being with us today. My question to you is, certainly, any of us can understand why we might need more licenses and, some special accommodations during this challenging time. But I don't see that the disaster needs to be extended. Cannot we do this through another bill without extending the disaster? I mean, we have made special bills for the military and the military wives, and I think Senator Kawasaki, took the lead in regards to that. So I don't understand why we need this whole kit and caboodle. It sounds like just the need for wanting federal funds, which I think there's other alternatives for that. But you don't have to have the disaster extended to do that. Is that correct?
Thank you. Again, this is Sarah Chambers through the chair, Senator Rheinbold. Most of the boards do lean on the declaration of a disaster or a public emergency to be able to issue those courtesy licenses. That is one of the side rails that I mentioned earlier to answer Senator Begich's question. And it, again, it depends on the license type, but there needs to be a finding of an emergency or an emergent situation in order for the board to authorize those courtesy licenses for that purpose.
Follow-up, Senator Reinbold.
Okay, so you're saying you have to have this bill. I want to make sure that I'm hearing you. You have to have a disaster declaration, an emergency in place to do this. You have no other means, and it cannot be done through any other legislation. Is that what I'm hearing?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, there could be other means for the legislature or the governor to declare an emergency, and this is the vehicle in front of the legislature now. So we could certainly look at other ways for an emergency to be declared, and I'd be happy to explore that. But the vehicle in front of us now is an opportunity to continue what the legislature did last year that really helps economic development and to deliver those health care services to people in that short amount of time.
Follow-up question,
okay.
Senator Hughes.
Okay, so you're telling us that we cannot, you have to have an emergency in order to do this. It sounds like you have to have an emergency to make any special accommodations. And in regards to the economic development, a lot of people are in economic crisis right now. Businesses are going out. So you got to look at this holistically. I've never seen more people suffering. I've never seen more businesses suffering in my entire life. I mean, it's our community in Anchorage. I was raised there, and it's almost unrecognizable. So if you're talking about economic growth, declaring an emergency, honestly, is not the best way to do it. So I guess I'm going to hold you to your word that you say you cannot do this unless you're in an emergency. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Hughes.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just think that we may hear more about this, but the ordinances at the municipal level are separate from what we're dealing with here. And I do feel for those in the municipality of Anchorage. Part of my district is municipality of Anchorage. Part of it's Mat-Su, and Mat-Su has not suffered in the same way. So we need to keep in mind that some of the things at the home rule level have made it worse for Alaskans. But I did want to say, Ms. Chambers, the legislature could pass a bill that has nothing to do with an emergency disaster that would provide the same provisions. And we could do it for telehealth. We could do it for fingerprinting. We could do it for meeting of shareholders, and I think the chair maybe has a bill to do that. We could do it for charitable gaming. Any of these changes could be made, and we could do them for the long term, or we could set a date for them, but it would not, my understanding, and if Department of Law wants to correct me, I think we could make any of these changes without the declaration being in existence. And if that's incorrect, Commissioner, you can let me know. But I think that we would have the ability to do that. And that is something when Senator Costello brought up her lack of comfort level for going as late along as September. I think any of these things that we thought would be important, so perhaps we're not at the level where we're worried about hospital capacity, but we are still wanting people to get readily access healthcare services. It might make total sense for us to provide the telehealth provisions being suggested in this bill, even if there is not a disaster declaration in place. So if I'm wrong about that, Commissioner, please let me know.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Director Chambers?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This again, Sarah Chambers, through the chair. Senator Hughes, I appreciate your comments. And as I mentioned to answer Senator Reinbold's question earlier, there are other vehicles to accomplish the particular carve-outs or the particular areas relating to licensing. There are different ways for the legislature to accomplish those goals, and the governor did propose some of those goals last year, pre-COVID, in a couple of his bills, and you may see some similar types of legislation coming forward, and certainly we would be interested in speaking with members of the legislature about some of those goals, which again predated COVID, So there, I wanted to just clarify that there are other means for our licensing aspects to be taken up in front of the legislature, if it's the will of the legislature to move those forward this session. And I can't speak to the other areas that would require a particular type of emergency declaration that, as Senator Reinbold pointed out, may speak to federal funding opportunities. That is separate from licensing. Altogether, this vehicle is a very useful tool to serve Alaska during this time, but I do want to be very clear that the licensing aspects could be utilized outside of this legislation, as the governor suggested pre-COVID last year.
Thank you. Going to Section 6.
Thank you, Chair. So Section 6 is telehealth and telemedicine. Telemedicine. So for the record, this is Commissioner Crum with Health and Social Services. It allows for the healthcare provider licensed, permitted, or certified in another jurisdiction to practice telehealth in Alaska without first conducting an in-person physical examination or being licensed in Alaska. The telehealth services provided must be within a provider's authorized scope of practice. If the provider determines the encounter will extend beyond the scope of practice or services, the provider must notify the patient and recommend the patient contact a healthcare provider licensed in Alaska. The healthcare provider cannot charge unreasonable fees, and the fees must be consistent with the ordinary fees charged for that service. It may not be more than 5% above the ordinary fees typically charged.
Senator Casella.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. So in the material provided, it says that this would allow you as commissioner to waive any state law or regulation related to telehealth or telemedicine if compliance would substantially prevent or impede healthcare services. It goes on to say the department anticipates there could be additional costs incurred due to the unknowns of COVID if the federal and state disaster declarations do not terminate at the same time, which you have established as September 30th. My office contacted Legislative Research, and we received information that says that we've been reviewing executive orders from states to determine if any have extended disaster declarations related to COVID-19 through September 30th, 2021, in the manner of Senate Bill 56. We have not located any instances of such an extension having been affirmed by a state legislature. And then it goes on to say that in many other states, the governors have the authority to extend a declaration by 30, 45, or 60 days, which we do. So I wanted to, again, hit on that point about the extension date, but could you tell me or give an example of a telehealth or telemedicine law or regulation that actually impedes healthcare services? Because when I voted on that legislation, it was my understanding that we actually were expanding access for Alaskans via telehealth and telemedicine. So I'm a little confused about how telemedicine could prevent or impede healthcare services.
Through the chair, Senator Costello, what this specifically says is under this disaster declaration extension is that healthcare providers license outside of the jurisdiction of Alaska. Typical rules and regulations inside of Alaska say you have to be licensed within the state and you must first have an in, and if you're not, you must have an in-person visit prior to. And that is what has been waived throughout this. This is a flexibility that CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, has allowed through the federal public health emergency. And in order to meet that flexibility, we have to waive this provision.
Yes, Senator Casella.
So, Commissioner, are you saying that when the legislature had exhaustive hearings on telemedicine that we sort of missed the mark because we didn't allow for that flexibility at that time?
It, through the chair, Senator Costello, no. I believe this is the exigent circumstances of the disaster, inability to travel. Also, individuals who could take advantage of telehealth, you don't want to have an unnecessary in-person event. And so we don't want to lose the ability to have out-of-state providers, which typically in the past would rotate up to Alaska, have their in-person clinics, and then have a patient. This is something that we want to normally protect our Alaskan licensed providers. And so this is something that I don't believe the legislature could have even contemplated at the time.
Through the chair.
Yeah, and maybe Director Chambers could also provide some information. I know that she was in front of the committee last year and explained this during the nurse compacting agreement as well, that you have to be a licensed provider in the state that you're practicing in. So if you're a telemedicine provider in Texas, you have to be licensed in Alaska to take that phone call in Texas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Commissioner, are you saying that we have to have an extension of the disaster declaration in order to address this issue?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, this is an item, yes, in order to address that issue is something that we put forward to meet those federal flexibilities.
Does it have to be in this legislation?
In this particular, that is up to the legislature in order to do this. For the timeline that we're talking about in order to meet the current one, which expires on February 14th, then yes, this was the most expedited vehicle in order to do so.
Thank you.
Senator Ramblin, and Senator. Senator Hughes.
Well, that's the follow-up, because you didn't respond when I made the comment, but as far as telehealth, just like the professional licensing, the fingerprinting, the meeting of shareholders, charitable gaming, we could make the decision, could we not, to change those either temporarily or permanently, whether or not there's a disaster declaration. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I will not speak to what the legislature can and cannot do, but I would believe so, ma'am.
Okay.
And that's something that, again, I guess I'll ask that question to Director Chambers, is that I understand that some of the professional licensing boards, they have the regulatory process, and then would we supersede their regulatory process by creating statute, or with the best means was the having the emergency disaster declaration so those regulations could be waived without us having to go through the regulatory process. Director Chambers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sarah Chambers for the record. The section on telemedicine and telehealth that's in the bill has allowed, as it was previously iterated through SB 241 and is reiterated here, gives boards and our division the opportunity to allow telehealth to happen, which would not otherwise happen because of existing state statutes. Boards and many of our non-boarded programs do not have the authority, because it is in state law, to allow people to practice telehealth on an Alaskan in the state of Alaska, because state law does not permit it. So it would require a statutory change or a suspension of those statutes as proposed in the bill to enable this telehealth provision.
And I guess the other question would be on professional occupational licensing question. Would that be better suited through a statute to change that, or would we have to change the regulatory process as well? And would that, obviously that goes through the Department of Law and the Lieutenant Governor's office, or would that be best done by statute?
Mr. Chairman, this is Sarah Chambers. The licensing provisions that are being requested in the bill are being made because they require statutory changes. Our boards have done everything that they have been able to accomplish through the regulatory process, and these are some of the remaining areas that require legislative action in order to provide the flexibility that our healthcare facilities and patients in Alaska have needed during the pandemic. And so these require changes in state law.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Begich and Senator Reinbold.
I think just as a point of clarification, Mr. Chairman, for all members, that just like with SB 2241 when it was introduced, we adjusted it, changed it, and added to it. We added a number of provisions, everything from relating to contracts and housing and other issues and mortgages to other things. We have the ability to change this bill any way we wish. Secondarily, there's nothing that's being described here that if we wanted to make a permanent change, we couldn't make a separate standalone piece of legislation. In fact, my objection to the nurse compact last year, which was a separate piece of legislation, was precisely because it seemed to weaken the standards. It appeared to weaken the standards for nursing qualifications here. So, Senator Hughes, if I may, through the chair, I think the answer to your question is yes, we have the power to do all of those things, and yes, we are going to adjust this bill. Senator Costello's comments and Senator Reinbold's comments speak to that. We are going to adjust this bill through the process, and we will do it collaboratively, I'm certain. And so I just wanted to, I know that the commissioner wants to get through his presentation, Mr. Chairman, but I want you to know that we have the power at any given moment to make these changes permanent if we wish.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Senator Reinbold.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I'm just going to go back and echo some of Senator Begich's in regards to Senate Bill 241. I talked to Ledge Legal yesterday, and they told me it was only referred to rules. I was never offered an opportunity in any way. I think the hearing was between midnight and 2 a.m. roughly when I actually heard it for the first time because it was only referred to rules. Correct me if I'm wrong. Am I wrong, Senator Begich?
If I may, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Begich.
Yeah, that was actually extensively debated in finance committees in both bodies, and so it was finance and rules, I believe, was what it was debated in. And it was extensively debated in rules because the minority had a number of provisions they hoped to add. And so it was in more than one committee. And I only was able to comment on it because I sat on Rules Committee.
Okay. Through the chair?
Senator.
Okay, so it was just misinformation potentially that I got yesterday. So thank you for that. The only time I actually, because I remember watching it, it was about midnight to 2 a.m. and then it went directly out on the floor. So caught a lot of us that were not on finance and not on rules tremendously off guard. And I remember it was like House and Senate members at this table. And it was like,
again, I'm Mr. Sorry, Chairman, for clarification, it was the conference committee.
The conference committee, correct. The free conference committee, correct. That came in roughly between midnight and 2 a.m. And then it went directly on the floor. So a lot of people were just, you know, we didn't know what COVID was. There was all this, you know, the governor was throwing all these travel mandates down, and we didn't know if we were going to get stuck in here. And I know that it ended up going after a tremendous amount of amendments because I remember watching amendment after amendment after amendment from this table, and then it was thrown out. So it really was not a well-vetted bill, and I think a lot of people have serious remorse about that. But the bottom line here is let's go ahead and talk about Section 6. Section 6. What I've learned through the chair too is you said that we could amend this bill and change it and all that. Well, I just read an email that said all of our amendments are due tomorrow. So it's the first meeting, first time introducing the bill, first time hearing, and all our amendments are due tomorrow when we're still just getting a basic grasp. Is that the cutoff date, Mr. Chairman, for the amendments, 5 p.m. tomorrow?
We're still working through that. We're obviously not through this presentation, so that probably will be extended here because we need to get through with the presentation before we do that. That was my intent to have the at least the first presentation of the sectional done and throughout some of the other presentation of the initial hearing first done today. So that's probably going to be moved back to another day or so. But let's see what we can do to get through, and then we'll have a sort of a new date and time.
Can I ask a question about Section 6?
Yes, please ask the question.
Okay, so there's people listening online, and it's kind of hard because they may not have the bill through us. So just in layman's term, one, if you could talk about Section 6 and why it's a the concern for me is because I worked on the telehealth bill. I thought it was a pretty interesting bill, and I think it was Liz Vasquez that ended up carrying that bill. And my understanding is of that bill, they put sidelines in order to protect Alaskan physicians so that everyone just didn't go and, you know, go outside because it's just so valuable to be able to see someone person to person, examine them, get to know them, rather than just a, you know, kind of an informal meeting online. It's just the quality of healthcare often goes way higher when someone's able to actually meet with a physician. Or physicians, you know, provider face-to-face. So, one, how has this changed from the really great teleconference bill that we used? And in layman's terms, if you could just say what Section 6 does, that would be terrific. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, this bill or this section allows an individual to get telehealth without having to go through an in-person appointment. And that is one of the aspects of this. It actually allows an individual to not have to go because we know that social distancing and aerosol are how it spreads. And so for those vulnerable populations who want to stay at home and protect themselves, this allows them to still get access to medical care without having to go through the in-person appointment.
Yes, Senator Amel.
So through the chair, that's exactly it's line on line page 7, line 22. That's exactly what I was hoping that you would say to me. I understand, you know, about social distancing and whatever, but the ability for a patient, I love that in the bill, that it required them the first visit to have an in-person so they could get to know the physician. And they're having worked in a medical clinic and a medical office, I know how valuable that is. So I will tell you that does raise a red flag. I understand theoretically, but with the herd immunity potentially being reached and some of the mitigation measures and the American doctors on the front line that have dealt with so many patients and had such remarkable outcomes, I think that definitely causes me pause. What my question is, this does talk about diagnosis, prescribing, dispensing, and administering prescriptions, and excluding controlled substances. What my question to you is, ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, zinc, vitamin D, were those part of your disaster plan anywhere? And have they been completely and readily available for physicians? Or is there any restrictions on those agents at all anywhere, even including supply chains in Alaska?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, we talk on a weekly basis about available treatments and therapeutics. As therapeutics get approved by the FDA, they either come into the state or directly to hospital, and we actually work to make sure that they know how to administer those. As far as other items, if they are commercially available and a doctor wants to give that to their patient, there's, as long as it's in the scope of their license, there is nothing to the state. We're restricting that.
Yes, Paula.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just answer me. Is ivermectin been readily available and it's known, you know, to have very, very good outcomes? Hydroxychloroquine, has there been any restriction or any supply issues? And yes or no, have they been part of your plan in this disaster plan, knowing that D, vitamin D, zinc, ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine are excellent plans? This is a super important, a lot of physicians and doctors and people have been asking me to make sure I get this on the record. So I need you'd be very clear.
Through
very
the chair
honest.
To Senator Reinbold, all available commercial items a doctor can prescribe or give to their patient. We are not going to get in the way of that. We have spoken frequently about the beauty of prevention using zinc and vitamin D. We've got articles that are posted on the Health and Social Services website about the importance of vitamin D for respiratory illnesses. And so we as the state do not restrict, and if there is commercially available, they can do this. And so from our perspective, we don't work with that. If a pharmacist wants to have that conversation with the provider, that's between them. As the state, we do not actually get in the way of that. The only treatments that we deal with are the ones that come through the FDA emergency use authorization process for therapeutics.
One final drill down, Mr. Chairman.
Quickly.
Ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. Can you just tell me the availability and if you authorized its use, if there have been any restrictions in any way? This is a very, very important because it saves lives. I mean, that genuinely saves lives. And if you say it's to promote health and welfare, you know, having ivermectin.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, those were not items that came through the FDA emergency use authorization process, so my department has nothing to do with that. I do not know if they are commercially available. I am not a provider. If a provider wishes to find those and prescribe those to their patient, they can.
So through the chair, there's been no ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine plan, it sounds like, from the disaster plan. I just want to get that on the record. It's super important.
Thank you. Section 7, please.
Section 7 is fingerprinting. Provides that DCCED shall coordinate with Health and Social Services and Public Safety to expedite the process for licensing for certain licensed applicants to submit fingerprints. This kind of coincides with Section 5 on the professional licensing side and the courtesy. We still trying to do is, while we try to expedite, we're trying to move things along as fast as possible if individuals come through and meet the requirements.
All right. Senator Costello.
Oh, thank you. So in the material provided by the state, it says that the bill mandates coordination between three departments to expedite the fingerprinting, and I'm just curious, is it possible just to work together and to expedite, or do we actually have to have this in legislation that we're forcing people to work together? Because I understand the value of speeding up the process. Is that something that we can do outside of a statute?
Mr. Chair, on the line, there is actually a representative from Public Safety, and this is has to do with their department, their section of the bill.
Yes. Who do we have? Public Safety. We have Lisa Burt Puritan, the Borough Chief of Public Safety. Ms. Puritan, are you on line with us?
To the Chair, yes, this is Lisa Puritan from the Alaska Department of Public Safety.
Yes. Did you get the question from Senator Costello?
I'm afraid I did not.
All right. If you want to restate that.
Okay. Thank you. So the material I received on the for today's hearing says that the bill mandates coordination between three departments, including yours,
Commerce, and then also Health and Social Services. And my question is, I understand the value of expediting fingerprinting processing, and I just wanted to know, why is that something that has to be mandated in a state statute, and is and couldn't we just make that process more efficient, considering the need for those fingerprinting, you know, fingerprints to be processed?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, with the my understanding of the intention on this is, with the expedited request, there is an allowance for processing name-based background checks in lieu of the fingerprint submission to actually delay the submission of fingerprints at a later date when there is an emergency situation at the state level. The Department of Public Safety has requested to allow these exigent circumstance requests to process name-based checks without the fingerprint submissions right away, with the understanding that those fingerprints will become available within 180 days of the end of the emergency declaration, or if the fingerprints become available, they can certainly, the agency can submit those fingerprints sooner than the 180-day mark to meet the federal requirements for submitting these fingerprints for non-criminal justice purposes. So that would be one of the reasons to have this requirement.
Okay, Senator Costello, follow-up?
Thank you. So I'm glad I asked the question, because prior to your answer, I was assuming that the protection of Alaskans and the standard for that would remain the same, and we would just be expediting the processing. But what I understand you telling me is that there's going to be a different process, where it's simply name-based check, and then the rest of the process would happen within 180 days, possibly faster. In your opinion, is there any detrimental impact to the safety of Alaskans by having this a name-based check?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, I can't really speak to that. We don't have statistics on that information, but the information would be searched based on the person's demographic information, so it's the name, date of birth, generally the Social Security number that is searched for the criminal history records. It would just be absent the fingerprint submissions, and the fingerprint submissions would follow up the name-based check. So we would still do the fingerprint-based check. It just wouldn't happen immediately if this request was processed for exigent circumstances. And just to kind of answer your earlier concerns, the Department of Public Safety certainly does process all fingerprint cards for various applicant purposes as expeditiously as we possibly can. Just looking at a quick check on the records that we've run in 2020 on behalf of the Department of Commerce for the various entities that they license for, our turnaround time was an average of 4.8 days, so and that's over a year's time frame. So we do try to expedite those in general, just to alleviate the concerns you may have for that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Hughes.
Just to clarify that, so the name-based check is not allowable under current statute. You actually have to have this Section 7 in order to implement the name-based check to move forward?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, the question regarding the exigent circumstances, I don't know that it's necessarily based in statute. Right now, the request was made to the Compact Council that oversees the governing body that oversees all non-criminal justice applicant background check processes through various state and national databases. And with that, the exigent circumstances were permitted due to the emergency disaster declaration for the state.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Bureau Chief. Commissioner, if you want to continue on to Section 8.
Yeah, for Section 8, this has to do with the meeting of shareholders and the notice of shareholder meetings. This is another section under Commerce. It allows for meetings of shareholders. shareholders of NATO corporations and members of nonprofit corporation to be held by electronic communication in compliance with guidelines adopted by each of the entities of board of directors.
Section 9.
For Section 9, this is charitable gaming of online ticket sales. This has to do with the Department of Revenue. This allows for certain charitable gaming activities to be conducted online during the public health disaster emergency declared by the governor on January 15th, 2021, and extended by this act. Permittees and operators may sell tickets and draw the winning ticket online for a raffle or lottery, dog mushers contest, derby, or a type of classic. The seller must verify that the purchaser is of legal age to purchase, physically present in Alaska, and not within an area where charitable gaming is prohibited. Department of Revenue is responsible for establishing the standards for the online ticket sales.
All right. Senator Begich.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to thank them for putting this provision in there, as it did, in fact, impact a bunch of charitable organizations that were doing this work. One of our constituents benefited from having the exception and seeing it in the bill. It makes it actually possible for some of those charitable organizations to continue their efforts, and so I just commend that section of the bill. I have a correction that I'll make on the record in just a moment about something I said earlier today, but not yet. I'll wait till after the presentation.
All right. Thank you. Senator Reinbold.
Thank you. In regards to this section, we don't have to declare an emergency, correct? This is another perfect instance where we can deal this with another bill. I know Senator Click Bishop has some great gaming ideas, and he did one for education, but I actually think this is interesting. I haven't vetted it really well, but to me this is another perfect, we're a senator, a legislator, because as you all know, I'm trying to embolden and empower the legislative branch in a rightful and due place, and I really believe all that the federal funds that should be coming through us, and I also think legislation should be coming through the legislature and a legislature. But is it correct that this could be dealt with very easily through another piece of legislation, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, I mean, the answer is yes. I mean, everything that we can be done by legislation, I think the, like Section 8, I have a bill on Section 8. So that's something that anyone could pick up and obviously drop a piece of legislation on. I know that the fishing game folks are also very pleased to have that piece in there just because of the local restrictions that are in certain communities allow their citizens to partake in those charitable gaming activities online. Senator Casella.
Thank you, and the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee looks forward to hearing your bill next Wednesday.
Thank you. Commissioner, Section 10 through 12.
Section 10, this amends Sections 37, Chapter 10, SLA of 2020. So this is a technical cleaning up. Repeal Section 29 of SB 241, Purchase of Seafood for Distribution, effective March 11th, 2021. Repeal Section 31 of SB 241, Tolling of Office of Administrative Hearings, effective March 11th, 2021. And SB 241 provided a sunset date for these sections of March 11th, 2021.
Senator Hughes.
So what is left in 241 that's not being repealed? So I know there was, I believe we had some kind of rent moratorium, different things like that. So what is left that we're not repealing?
Mr. Chair, there is a Department of Law representative online who can help answer that question.
Yes, and I think it's also on a later slide, too, we talk about some of the initial health mandates and what was expired. But yes, Department of Law, we have
Susan Pollard.
Yes.
This is Susan Pollard from the Department of Law. And Mr. Chairman and Senator Hughes, I understand your question to be sort of what is left of SB 241 or why is that bill referred to in this particular, in SB 56. Is that correct, Senator Hughes?
Yes. My question is,
Chair. Senator Hughes is going to restate her question for you, Ms. Pollard.
Right. So if Sections 10 and 12 were passed, what would be left of SB 241? What is not repealed based on Sections 10 through 12?
Again, Susan Pollard for the record, through the Chair, Senator Hughes. most of, as you recall, SB 41, which is also Chapter 10, SLA, Session Law of Alaska 2020, most of those provisions have already expired in that bill. However, in Section 37 of SB 241, five different provisions did not repeal until March 11, 2020. So what SB 56 does through Section 11 is it amends, but through Section 10 and 11, is it amends SB 241 to retain particular provisions that would have repealed March 11, 2022. And those are Sections 25, relating to video conferencing for will signatures, Sections 26, related to unfair and deceptive trade practices, and Section 28, relating to access to federal education state funds. And does that answer your question?
Could you repeat that last one? I didn't quite hear it.
Yes, ma'am. So the very last one, and again, if you look in SB 56 on page 10, line 9, section 11, you'll see that we have moved three sections from SB 241 into that section. So the last section that I mentioned was section 28. And again, when I say section 28, I'm referring to chapter 10, SLA 2020, SB 241. And Section 28 of SB 241 is state access to federal education stabilization funds under the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act. And you'll find that section in SB 241 as Section 28 on page 22 of SB 241.
Okay, thank you. And a follow-up?
Yes, Senator Heath.
So there are still unused funds, and that's one of the reasons why we need that to extend beyond March for the education funds?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I do not know the answer to that question right off. I'm not sure if the representative from OMB may know that, but if not, we can reach out to the Department of Education and get an answer to you.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Chair, again, these are things that the legislature could decide to keep in place on a temporary or permanent basis, regardless of whether the disaster declaration is extended.
Well, let's get Director Steininger on the line here from the Office of OMB.
Hello, for the record, this is Neil Steininger, Director of OMB, and I'm sorry, could you please repeat the question? I missed a little bit of it there.
So I guess the question that Senator Hughes asked was about sort of the education funding and part of Senate Bill 241. Would this still need to go forth in order for us to continue to receive the education funding through the CARES Act or
Future Act?
Feature acts.
So in order to receive the education funding that, you know, that we've received from the prior two relief packages with funding that goes out to school districts, we've needed appropriations for federal receipts. We've utilized the RPL process in the past. That would be available to receive additional funding in the future. It can be used for kind of funding for any purpose, and isn't necessarily reliant specifically on this disaster declaration.
Okay. Thank you. And Senator Begich has a question.
It's more of a clarification. So, Neil, if I'm right, Director, it's you're really basically saying you don't need Section 28. We can do it anyway through the RPL process. Is that what I heard you just say?
I think I might have missed part of the earlier context of the question related to Section 28, if you don't mind.
This is in Section, Mr. Chairman, for clarification. Uh-huh. This is in Section 11 of the current bill, line 9, page 10. It says it's Section 25, 26, and 28, Chapter 10 SLA, which is the former 241, are repealed, and then it gives the dates of the repeal. And it's because you don't need them. because we have the power to do that through the RPL process. That's what I think I just heard you say, and I just want to clarify that on the record.
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Director. All right. With that, any other questions? I think we are on page four.
Yeah, we essentially covered sections 11 and 12 with the last conversation.
Yes, sorry, the effective date sections.
And then, so section 13 has to do with the effective date. And for the record, this is Commissioner Crum. Apologize. If sections 1 through 10 and section 12 take effect after February 14th, 2021, the sections are retroactive to February 14th, 2021. So it's a retroactivity clause if the committee and the legislature go through their process. And then section 14 is another effective date, saying the underlying bill has an immediate effective date clause if passed.
So just a point of clarification before we get to Senator Baggage, that if for some reason the legislature decides to pass some version of Senate Bill 56, that the date would be retroactively to February 14th, so that there would be no gap of whatever the legislature assumes to pass.
Yes.
Thank you, Senator Baggage.
That gets to my question, Mr. Chairman. So, Commissioner, what will the governor do if we don't pass this bill? And the declaration obviously will expire on the 14th of February. What is the governor's intent?
I can't speak for the governor's office directly, but I do know that the legislature is through the chair, Senator Baggage. Legislature is meeting and in session, so it is up to the legislature to extend this or not. And so if that doesn't happen, I don't believe another disaster declaration will occur.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if I may make my clarification for my earlier statement, I said that the bill had gone to finance first. SB 242 went to finance first. And sections of SB 242 were then, after extensive debate, rolled into 241 in the Rules Committee, which was, they were correct, they gave you the right information, Senator Reinbold. The Rules Committee then had only seen 241. The discussion occurred on 242, was rolled into 241. It went to the floor, extensively debated and amended by you and me and others. We all proposed amendments. And then it went to the House. The House extensively amended the bill as well, sent it back to us, went to free conference committee, and then the late night free conference committee meeting occurred. So I just wanted to clarify that for the record. You were correct. I was incorrect on terms of the single referral.
Thanks. All right. Senator Reinbold, then Senator Hughes.
Can I just say thank you very much? It was confusing. I recall, you know, the 242, 241, but I just want to make sure, because it was legal, that told me the information. We were looking at the information.
Correct,
So thank you very, very much for the clarification of the rules. When the opportunity is right, I don't want to cut in front of her, but I do have three questions I'd like to get on record, but I want to wait my turn.
All right. Senator Hughes.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So big high-level overarching question, two of them. The first one is, and I want to keep an open mind for you to make your case, but I have concerns. So I want to know from you, based on what we learned today, we could actually remove extending the emergency declaration, remove it. It could just end. I think we could even put in statute that we're ending it, you know, the date of passage. But all those other things we could independently do. So, and SB 56 could be the vehicle for some of those. The declaration extension, though, I want to know what specific advantages it is to the administration to extend, because it's not the FMAP enhancement. You said we can get that anyway. We can do the telehealth and all those other things in all those sections, the professional licensing, the fingerprinting, the shareholder meetings, the online charitable gaming. We can do all that regardless of the extension of the declaration. So what is the advantage to extending the declaration? Why do you feel like you need it?
And
I'll through the chair, Senator Hughes, I imagine we're going to have to carry on testimony to another day, sir.
Yes.
To do that broadly, that is the bulk of the rest of the presentation, is actually doing this. We had to introduce the bill and go through the sectional analysis. The key thing is under Section 2, the disaster declaration extension, it is the powers under AS 2623 are the primary vehicles in order for us to continue the response. It has to do with items with rapid procurement, along with justifications, in order to do items like mass vaccination clinics. The point of dispensing clinics, which have been occurred around the state and been so successful in keeping Alaska at number one in the vaccinated per capita, have occurred through us being able to do rapid contracting with local providers and groups, procurement of space, and items like this. Typical government procurement process takes about 3 months. And so if without the abilities to do that, we are looking at, we would probably fall to the back of the pack in vaccinations as a whole. We wouldn't be able to distribute and use testing as rapidly in order to keep staff on with letters of agreement with unions. The whole situation and the response, all of the safety metrics where Alaska leads, we would probably fall way down the pack. And that is primarily why. And, sir, before I may, just one statement I wanted to get on the record, because I imagine we're going to close up here shortly, is something that Senator Hughes had actually alluded to earlier, and this is about the Alaska system of local government as set forth in our state constitution. So Article 10, Section 1 of the Alaska Constitution requires a liberal construction be given to the powers of local governments. This constitutional provision confers on local governments a broad grant of authority. This means that most local governments in Alaska do not necessarily need an express grant of authority from the state in order to act. For example, the municipality of Anchorage can issue emergency declarations and take emergency measures because neither state law nor their charter prevent such action. The Disaster Act does not prohibit local governments from taking actions necessary to manage disasters within their affected community. Accordingly, because the legislature has granted many local governments those powers, quote, not otherwise permitted by law, these local governments have legal authority to take actions they deem necessary to address the public health disaster, provided those actions are not prohibited as a matter of law.
All right.
Okay, and follow up?
Yes.
So it primarily for vaccine distribution and testing is what I'm hearing for the extension. So I believe as a legislator, we could grant you that absent of a disaster declaration. We could just grant you the ability to, you know, be able to expedite distribution and testings, et cetera. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I am not entirely sure on that. It's because of the certain processes for the governor's ability to waive or suspend regulations and statute as well. To allocate scarce resources is another item. So the governor under a disaster declaration has the authority to allocate scarce resources such as food, water, fuel, and medicine. This would include therapeutics and vaccines. And so at this point in time, vaccines, we have an eligibility criteria set up to protect the most vulnerable. Without the ability to allocate that, we actually would probably lose our eligibility criteria, meaning that it would just be vaccines available, anybody can get it.
And for the record, you know, you could always, for alternative care sites, what helps sets up those alternative clinics, you have to waive, I think it's a certificate of need?
It's a certificate of need. Oh, touche.
Thank you.
And the second question, and I know we're running out of time, and so this is probably one to, I want to get it on the record, and I think it's really important, and I alluded to it early in the hearing, is what is the criteria, the actual numerics and metrics that you would use if you were granted an extension that would trigger it ending?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, thank you for that. So there is a number of metrics involved. It kind of depends on what's going on. But one of the things that we would absolutely look at and would be a primary decider is there enough vaccine available in the state and distributed for those willing to take it? And at that point in time, if vaccine hesitancy takes over, people don't want to take it because it's an individual choice, then the issue is there. The tools are there. They've been distributed. And then local communities and individuals can make that choice. That is one metric that we have talked about internally, is the ability to do that. And that depends upon federal allocations and production schedules. And so we don't have a particular time frame on what that looks like, but that is a very big metric that we would look at. It's like, okay, we have prepared ourselves to where now we can help deal with this response.
And will you provide that? So say, okay, based on the population, this is how many we want distributed and when we hit that point. So will you actually be presenting that to us?
We can through the chair, Senator Hughes, yeah.
So we are...
Mr. Chair, I do have an important point to make.
Yes, but before we do that, I'm just going to remind the committee that due to our wonderful COVID procedures, we have to exit this room because they have to sanitize, clean, and get ready for the next committee, which is going to be another lively bill discussion. And so we want to make sure that we're respectful to our other colleagues as well. So with that, briefly... questions that will take less than 30 seconds to get an answer from.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did want to say I'm reading from the state statutes right now about the powers of the legislative branch and the governor, and it says here the legislature may terminate a disaster emergency at any time by law. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Senator Reinbold, then we're going to go to closing comments.
Mr. Chairman, I actually have several questions for Commissioner Crum. However, I'm going to ask you, because the vaccines are a huge, huge issue, this is health and social services, I'm going to ask you to dedicate an entire time to that because it's, I think it's very, very important. I want to know things like who has the liability, you know, if there's an adverse reaction to it. Does the state, because the state is pushing the vaccines, is it the person that administers the vaccines? Where does the liability lie if there's an adverse reaction? I think knowing that this is a new type of vaccine that's only been roughly 7 months when the average is about 7 years. These are not FDA approved. They are not FDA approved. They're only authorized for emergency
Senator
use.
Reinbold, we will have a vaccine hearing later on throughout the session, but I have this bill, another bill that has sort of time restraints, and so after that is over, we will set up a vaccine hearing on
Through the chair, I definitely would like to get these questions on record at the next committee hearing, if possible. Well, I definitely these need to be gotten on record. Do yes or no? Do they have to sign informed consent and be Commissioner Crum? Yes or no? Can he just ask a yes or no?
But not on these type of not on the vaccine type related questions. I mean. That's something that we, if you want to get the questions, we can try to get those answers ahead of time for their
next Chairman, presentation. Mr. Chairman, this is a huge issue. There could be people dying, paralyzed, deaths. I just need to know, yes or no, do they have to sign informed consent? And where's the liability lie if there's an adverse event? So, I think that's a very fair question.
It is a fair question, but if you wanted to give us your questions, we can get that to the commissioner's office. And they can hopefully provide those in writing to the entire committee and get those out to us.
So with that, Mr. Chairman, so the answer is yes, we can have a vaccine, it sounds like. And yes, can I get your yes or no in regards to providing the model and the problems with the model? Can I officially ask this to be
part of that.
Okay, excellent. And the last thing I'd like to talk about at a future time is because one of the main parts of this is how much money he has in his budget and how much, maybe you can answer that right now. Your total budget, I believe, is around $4 billion. How much extra money have you gotten since the COVID, roughly, just at a high level?
And we're going to finish this conversation. This isn't going to be the end of our emergency declaration bill. And the commissioner, I believe, in his office, we have him for the next 3 weeks of coming into this committee to present. I hope. Yes. So with that, we're going to have time to ask all those questions, Senator Reinbold, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful. I want to be respectful of our other committee times. With that, closing comments, Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to thank again you, Commissioner, for being here. I know we'll see you a lot and your staff a lot, and I'm looking forward to that. I do want to point out the emergency order does have an impact, Mr. Chairman, on legal liability for restaurants. They've done these new plans and things like that for extended service, and if the emergency orders expire, those plans actually go away. So there is that issue that needs to be discussed, and I know that's not the purview of this committee, but it does relate to the question about the emergency orders, and I wanted to put that on the record.
Yes.
Thank you very much for being here.
Yeah, there's a whole section in the presentation, I think a few pages of the why that we just didn't get to yet, and so I'm sure the commissioner will be ready to dive into those on Thursday. With that, that concludes our business today. We'll send out to committees another time and when amendments are due, so please disregard that other communication. And we are going to be adjourned at 3:04 p.m.